Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now. So I scraped and scrounged to get three new movies to review for you for this show for this week. I try to get a maximum of five movies. If I can get five, that's amazing. But if I can get three, that's good enough. And if I don't have at least three, then I usually have to scrape for some movie news to give you right now. But I did review three new movies. Two of them are brand new from these last 2 weeks. One of them actually came out in 2017, but did not debut on Netflix until this week, and I'm going to get to that in just a moment. Meanwhile, the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The Sleepover, a movie that premiered on Netflix on August 21st, 2020. It's about two siblings who discover their seemingly normal mom is a former thief in witness protection who has been forced to pull one last job. And when she does, they team up to rescue her over the course of an action-packed night. The kids in the movie, the two siblings, are Sadie Stanley, who plays the oldest daughter, Clancy, which, now that I think about it, is an unusual name for a woman, but it's a really good name. I might even consider, if I have a daughter, I might name her Clancy. Clancy Burke. That's got a good ring to it. But anyway, her younger brother is Kevin, who's played by a young actor by the name of Maxwell Simpkins. And Maxwell Simpkins actually had some screamingly funny lines in this movie. I won't give away what they are, but they did come somewhat unexpectedly. First, when you're introduced to him making a presentation in front of his class and blatantly lying about what his parents do for a living, basically taking what his parents do for a living from a famous movie that came out over the last 5 years. I won't tell you what that movie is, but you'll see the movie and you'll figure it out. Their mother is named Margot, and she's played by Swedish actress Malin Ackerman, who has been in so many movies. Her performances have usually been kind of hit or miss. She's best known for playing Lori Jupiter, also known as Silk Spectre 2, in Zack Snyder's 2009 movie Watchmen, which, again, was hit or miss in some parts. I didn't think she in that movie was particularly good. In fact, I think she was actually one of the worst actors in that movie. But she did redeem herself in several other movies after that, including one that I think is actually pretty underrated, but should be a cult classic over the next couple of years. It's one called The Final Girls, where she plays a former actress in an 80s movie where her jaded millennial daughter actually gets transported into that 80s movie, kind of a mix between Friday the 13th and Pleasantville. It's a very funny movie, and Malin Ackerman was very good in that film as well. And I think she's good in this movie, The Sleepover. She's married to Clancy and Kevin's father, whose name is Ron, and he's played by Ken Marino, who, again, is one of those actors who's usually very consistently funny, especially when he's in projects that are either written by and or directed by the likes of Michael Showalter and other such comic directors and writers. And he's best known for being in the MTV show The State, which was MTV's, I think, very first sketch comedy show. And it also launched the careers of Michael Showalter, David Wayne, Michael Ian Black, and several other comic actors like that. He was also in other movies like Wanderlust, and he's been in some TV shows like Children's Hospital. And the two of them are happily married until the woman Margot gets basically kidnapped by former thieves with whom she was acquainted, including one particular suave spy by the name of Leo, who's played by Joe Manganiello. And Joe Manganiello has been in several movies. He's best known for his supporting role in the Magic Mike films, both of them. He also played a version of himself in Pee-wee's Big Holiday, which was the last Pee-wee Herman movie. And he's also probably best known for being married to Sofia Vergara. And he certainly has moments where it doesn't look like he's trying to be funny, but he has a really good deadpan sense of humor that not a lot of actors, particularly those as good-looking as him, probably have, but it serves him well in this movie. I think that the movie being called The Sleepover was a little bit misleading, because the Sleepover is just one subset of the movie, and it's just one of the friends of the kid Kevin in this film having a friend who happens to be sleeping over. But the fact that they're focusing on a sleepover in this movie only takes about 5 minutes, and it's not particularly directed or doesn't really have very much to do with the plot of this film, of it being a action spy thriller comedy. It's just one of those things that kind of happens, especially considering that the older daughter, Sadie Stanley's character, is not having a sleepover. She's actually trying to sneak out to the party of a popular guy in her high school. Besides that main issue with the title of this film, I actually really enjoyed this film a lot more than I thought I would. It's rated TVPG, which means that kids can watch, and it's probably made, in a sense, for kids. It does have a lot of action in it, but it's not anything flagrantly violent. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't have been rated TVPG. I did like the actors in the film. I thought Malin Ackerman was good. I think Ken Marino did very well, sort of being kidnapped alongside his wife, Margot, who's in the witness protection program, until she gets, of course, captured by certain people from her past. And Ken Marino's character, Ron, has no idea about this, and I think his reactions are pretty good. I also think he plays off very well alongside Joe Manganiello, who definitely has a lot more going for him than Ken Marino's character in a lot of areas, and also has a really clever but subtle running gag where Joe Manganiello's character keeps forgetting Ken Marino's character's name, keeps calling him Rob or Roz. It's very funny when you see it in this movie. It's probably not funny when I explain it. But in addition to that, I did think that Sadie Stanley and Maxwell Simpkins acted very well in this film. It's also great that this movie takes place in Massachusetts. The family here lives in Cape Cod, and they eventually make their way to Boston. And once I saw the Boston skyline, especially the Citgo sign around Kenmore Square, I got instantly nostalgic about my fair city that in which I lived for 11 years, where this show to which you were listening, Words on Film, got its start. But besides my obvious Boston bias, I did think it was a competent and well-shot action movie. It also happened to be very funny, and the kids in the film, actually, not only the kids who played the children of Malin Ackerman and Ken Marino's characters, but also the actress who played Clancy's best friend, whose name is Cree Sacchino. I'm going to pronounce it that way. I almost mispronounced it. And also Kevin's friend Lewis, who's played by Lucas J. I also thought they did pretty well in their roles as well. I think that the character of Lewis might have overdone it a little, being the more squeamish of them. And there's a certain running gag of his where I guess his character has been known to wet the bed. And there's a running gag involving some monitor that he keeps in his underwear that goes off whenever his pants get wet. I didn't think that was particularly funny, but I did think about 85% of the gags worked here, which is why I give the movie The Sleepover my rating of a knockout. It is a good action comedy. I think it's very funny. It certainly was funnier than perhaps it was required to be, but I do give credit to writer Sarah Rothschild for writing a very clever story and screenplay to go along with this that does not insult the intelligence of children who might want to see this film, but also is not alienating to adults either. This is a very good film to watch, and if we weren't having the COVID-19 pandemic right now, I would recommend that this movie get released into theaters, because I would like to see it on the big screen. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The Lost Husband. This is based on a novel of the same name written by Catherine Center, with a screenplay written by Vicky White. And this is about a woman who named Libby, who, trying to put her life back together after the death of her husband, moves herself and her children to her estranged aunt's goat farm in Central Texas. Libby, who is played in this movie by Leslie Bibb, is a native, or I think she's been raised most of her life in Houston, Texas. And after her husband dies, she takes a risk by moving the family of hers that's still alive onto a goat farm that's run by a down-home Texan by the name of Gene, who's played in this movie by SNL alum Nora Dunn. And Nora Dunn was on Saturday Night Live. In fact, she was very funny on that show, especially when she was doing sketches with Jan Hooks. But a lot of the roles she's played after Saturday Night Live have been not so much funny, but still, she is good in this film as well. And you can definitely tell there's a love story that's going to go on here when Gene has a farmhand whose name is James O'Connor, and he's played by Josh Duhamel. And Josh Duhamel is best known, I think he's a good actor in his own right, but he's best known for having previously been married to Fergie, and unfortunately that relationship ended in divorce a couple of years ago, which I'm sorry to say. But he has also been in a couple of Transformers movies. He was Kristen Bell's love interest in the movie When in Rome, which came out, if you can believe it, about 10 years ago. And he's no stranger to romantic dramas, having also been in the movie Safe Haven, which is one of those romantic dramas that was based on a book written by Nicholas Sparks, and also co-starred Julianne Hough. And Josh Duhamel is definitely one of those actors who I think is okay. He's certainly very likable, but he usually plays the romantic lead in a movie, or at least the romantic co-star. He's the guy with whom you're rooting for the woman in the movie to eventually get. You can kind of tell when James O'Connor and Libby Moran are arguing in the very beginning of the film, and Leslie Bibb's character, Libby Moran, is struggling to keep up with the farm work, that eventually they're going to get together. And I gotta give credit to Leslie Bibb in this movie for playing someone who's actually likable. Because usually Leslie Bibb plays the other woman in a movie who's usually a man-eater. That's the kind of role she played in the first two Iron Man films, in Talladega Nights with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, also in the movie Wrist Cutters with Patrick Fugit and Shannon Sossaman. She is used to playing those kind of roles, and it is good to see her playing someone who you're not inclined to dislike, unless you're a man in one of these movies. But I also really liked the scenes between Leslie Bibb's character and her children in the film. I thought they did pretty well. The actors who played her children were Carly Pope, who plays her daughter, and Kevin Alejandro, who plays her son. I did think there was one unnecessary subplot in the movie involving Libby's daughter, Lainey. Again, that's Carly Pope's character, where she goes to a new school in this small Texas town, and she eventually gets into several confrontations with a boy in her class. And these confrontations are not just he said, she said. They eventually end up violent, where the guy actually ends up assaulting and battering her. And again, I think the subject in this film was handled a little too lightly in the context of this film. And I also thought that the way that the school officials in the movie reacted to it, getting the character Lainey in trouble as well as the guy who hit her, is not particularly realistic, I don't think. Then again, I don't work in a school these days, so I don't know what exactly the policies are, but when I went to school, if a guy or if a boy hit a girl, the boy got in trouble no matter what. And the girl usually did not get in trouble. And there's a very good reason for that. It's wrong to hit anyone, but it is especially wrong for a boy to hit a girl. And I feel like the way the supporting characters reacted to this, and also the way that the subplot was dropped, didn't really necessitate a place in this movie. I think that it was too serious a subject, A, to be handled as lightly as it was in this movie, and B, once they kind of address the issue in about two or three scenes, they just dropped that subplot altogether, which I do not think was a very wise move in general. The parts of the movie I did like was the genuine on-screen chemistry between Leslie Bibb and Josh Duhamel. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correct. I'm just pronouncing it the way I see it. And I also really liked Leslie Bibb's character's scenes with her mother, Marcia, who's played in this film by Sharon Lawrence, probably best known for her role as Dennis Franz's character's wife in NYPD Blue. His character was Andy Sipowicz. I temporarily forgot that. But I haven't seen Sharon Lawrence in a really long time, but she acts incredibly well in this film. And there's certainly a dynamic between her and Nora Dunn, and the two of them play sisters who couldn't be more different. But I think that they are different in a very realistic and poignant sense in this film. And I really thought that that subplot between Leslie Bibb and Sharon Lawrence was more realistic and fit in particularly better in this film as well. I also liked some other supporting characters like Isaiah Whitlock Jr., who was in Five Bloods, as well as several other Spike Lee films, but Five Bloods is the most recent film in which he acted, and he plays the love interest of Nora Dunn's character, and he also has a daughter named Sunshine, who's played by Harrison F. Guardiola, who's also a really good actress and stunning as well. So there is a lot to like about The Lost Husband. I did think that there were a couple of subplots that weighed the film down a little bit, especially when it came to Leslie Bibb's character's daughter and her adjustment to school. I didn't think that was necessary, but I did think that The Lost Husband had a certain advantage to it, unlike other similar romantic dramas that were based on books written by Nicholas Sparks. This is based on a book, as I said in the beginning of the segment, but it was written by Catherine Center, not Nicholas Sparks. And I think that Vicky White did a great job writing the screenplay and making the characters a lot better fleshed out. I just think that the subplot of the daughter in the school seemed to be more studio interference than anything. But I did like The Lost Husband a lot better than I thought I would, and I give it my rating of a checkout because I did really identify with the romance in the film. I thought the people who should have had great chemistry in this movie did, whether or not they were romantically linked. There were, again, subplots that didn't need to be there, but I was a lot more satisfied with this than I have been with other Nicholas Sparks-based movies or other similar romantic dramas that made their way to the big screen. In other words, this movie had a formula, The Lost Husband did, but it wasn't formulaic, and for that reason, I appreciated it, and I enjoyed it. Welcome back to the show, Words on Film. It is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Freak Show, which is not exactly a brand new movie. According to IMDb, it was released on January 12, 2018, but and it's considered a 2017 movie, but even though I went to the movies frequently in 2017 and 2018, as well as, well, this year until COVID-19 hit, I've never actually heard of this film. And Freak Show is based on a book written by James St. James. And James St. James, I'm familiar with for being, well, a very flamboyant personality. But he actually wrote the book, the nonfiction book Party Monster, which was made into a documentary as well as a movie in 2003 starring Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green. That was actually Macaulay Culkin's first movie in 9 years, and I haven't seen it. I'm a little afraid to see it because it is about a very grim topic as well as very, very weird people. But James St. James is still active in Hollywood, which is great that he's still working because he certainly knows how to tell a story. And if you know anything about James St. James and his flamboyant nature, Freak Show is not going to surprise you by its content. The movie is actually not rated, but if you were to give it a rating, it would probably be, I think, PG-13. But it follows the story of teenager Billy Bloom, who, despite attending an ultra-conservative high school, makes the decision to run for homecoming queen. And Billy is a guy, so that makes it all the more strange that he would actually be put in the running for homecoming queen. And he's played by a young actor by the name of Alex Lawther, who really goes all out in this movie. I don't know if Alex Lawther is actually gay, but I shouldn't presume that he is based on his performance, but if he isn't, that probably makes his performance all the more poignant. But Alex Lawther is actually no stranger to playing someone who is gay. As a matter of fact, probably his best known role is having been in the movie The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, where he actually played the young Alan Turing in that movie. And Alan Turing, in the movie and in real life, was a man who struggled with his homosexuality back at a time when homosexuality was considered a mental illness. It was considered a mental illness, at least in America, until about 1972, when the American Psychological Association took it off the books for being a mental illness. But even then, gay people, even to this day, even though they've certainly had a lot more rights that have been granted to them by the United States, particularly the Supreme Court, they still struggle, and they're probably going to struggle for the next 100 years, because there still are a lot of misconceptions about gay people, particularly amongst straight people who are not particularly well-informed. And when I saw this film, I see, of course, Billy Bloom moving from Connecticut, which I guess is a more liberal state. I guess that depends on in which city you reside, or what part of Connecticut you reside, but he moves to an undisclosed state, which is, I guess, a red state, but it's never determined what that state is. It could be Texas, it could be Tennessee, it could be Mississippi, who knows? But he moves there when his mother, whom he affectionately refers to as Muv, who's played by Bette Midler, goes away for a little while, and in what way, I'm not going to tell you, but he ends up staying with his estranged, divorced father, whose name is William, who's played in this movie by Larry Pine. And, of course, the relationship between William and Billy is very fraught. He does have a bit of an ally in his father's housekeeper, Florence, who's played by Celia Weston, who is very kind to Billy, but also very worried about Billy, who likes to dress in women's clothing and is a gay transvestite, really, fitting in into his new school where generally the population is a lot more narrow-minded. There are a few exceptions to that rule, including his first friend, who goes by the name Blah Blah Blah. That's her nickname. And she's played by the young actress Anna Sophia Robb. He also gets an unexpected ally in a football hero in the school whose name is Flip Kelly, who's played by Ian Nelson. And Ian Nelson and Alex Lawther act very well together, but as I was watching the movie, I was wondering, is this character Flip Kelly actually, it's very unusual for somebody who's on the football team to befriend somebody who is not only gay, but very flagrantly flamboyant, as Alex Lawther's character is in this film. So, yeah, even I began to think, well, it's one thing to be a nice person. It's another thing to befriend someone when it risks your reputation. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a straight football player having a friendship and just a platonic friendship with a gay classmate. I guess it just kind of goes to show you how far separated from high school I am, where words like queer and faggot were tossed around constantly and teachers didn't bat an eyelash. This was around 2002 was when I graduated, and I heard those words all the time. In fact, I was called a faggot probably an average of 3 times a week, and I'm not even gay. It's just one of those words, along with a woman or a bitch, that is demoralizing for a kid to hear, whether or not they are actually gay. So it really actually did kind of break my heart when I was watching this film and I saw kids, particularly young boys, in this movie calling the Billy Bloom character a fag. I would have thought, especially with the way that America has embraced gay people more than they did 10 years ago, and the rights and privileges that have been given to gay people that would have been unheard of 15 years ago, I would have thought that that mentality, even in conservative areas of the country, would have subsided. But yeah, unfortunately, that's not the case. But aside from that, I didn't exactly buy into the character Billy Bloom becoming as flamboyant as he was and gradually becoming more accepted into the school. I don't think that would have happened in such a high school in a conservative town. But again, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe high school kids are more open-minded than perhaps they were when I went to high school. But there were some things about this movie I loved. There were other things that I thought were a little questionable, including the relationship between Billy Bloom and Flip Kelly, which was platonic. I mean, I do credit this movie for maybe moving away from what you think probably would happen, and maybe even inserting a little bit of realism into the relationship between these characters, because you know when this friendship happens, either one of them's going to fall in love with the other one, they're both going to fall in love, they're going to have a major fallout, or all three are going to happen. And at least two of those things that I mentioned happen, but I'm not going to tell you which ones they are. I will say, however, that I did really like the subplot involving the absence of Billy Bloom's mother, whom he affectionately refers to as Muv, who's played in this movie by Bette Midler, who, when I think about it, must be, and especially in this movie, but not just necessarily in this movie, every gay man's dream mom, because she's great in this film. I mean, Bette Midler is, of course, a competent actress, and gay men love her as much as they do Barbara Streisand, Judy Garland, and Lady Gaga. And this movie was the perfect role for Bette Midler. And there's also a moment where Bette Midler's character comes to visit her son and her ex-husband in their sprawling mansion. And you think that she's going to take Billy Bloom away, but she doesn't, for a reason that I won't give away. But once you see it in this movie, it's a little bit heartbreaking. Actually, it's quite a bit heartbreaking. The part where the movie lost me is the third act, where the development of the subplot where Billy Bloom begins to run for homecoming queen, not homecoming king, gets going. I didn't think the way that resolved itself was very fitting for the movie, and it didn't seem particularly realistic to me either, both what happened and the other students' reactions to it. But I did think the first and the second act of this movie were strong. As a matter of fact, there's one scene, and I think this is inevitable in certain communities, where Billy Bloom comes to school dressed as a woman, and he's doing this not particularly to make a statement, but more because he's comfortable in those clothes, and he actually does get attacked by other students. It really is heartbreaking to watch, especially if you're gay, but even if you're straight, because I think everyone, or most everyone, has had moments in high school where they didn't fit in and they think that everyone's after them. But then there are some students who, there are certain people who are after them and who humiliate and demoralize, not to mention actually injure them. And it's really heartbreaking to watch, no matter what your religion, race, or orientation is. I think anyone who is different in any way can relate to that scene. So, Freak Show is a movie that is certainly an eye-opener. I think it has a very good place on Netflix where people can watch it at the click of a button as opposed to going out to theaters to see this. And I think it's a more fitting platform than in theaters. There are certain movies that are worth seeing in theaters and some that are worth seeing at home on TV. And this is one of those films. And it worked for me. It gets my rating of a checkout because I thought that there were a number of very poignant performances in this film. Of course, Alex Lawther is an actor to watch. And if he is not, in fact, gay, then that makes his performance all the more incredible. But even if he actually is, he still turned in a great performance despite his real-life sexual orientation. I also really liked Ian Nelson in this film. Anna Sophia Robb probably turns in her best performance of her young career. Abigail Breslin is also in this film. And I like the supporting performances by Bette Midler and Laverne Cox as well. So I think Freak Show, even if you're not gay, is worth seeing. And I think especially if you've been through high school or maybe are even going through and struggling with high school right now, it's also worth seeing because there is a lot in this movie that's universal. I just wish this movie had kept it up in through its third act. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I've reviewed all the movies I have to review for you for this show, it's now time for me to get into movies that are coming out on streaming this week, beginning on Sunday, August 23rd, and extending through Friday, August 28th. There are some interesting movies that are coming out, particularly on Netflix, on beginning Sunday, August 23rd. There's one film that came out in 2019 that's called One Bedroom. It was actually made in 2019 and was released somehow, probably on Amazon Prime, on April 24th, 2020. But it is debuting on Netflix on Sunday, August 23rd. The movie is called 1BR, which is short for one bedroom, as in an apartment. Anybody who's been looking for apartments in a city, just like I have with my recent home search, and I found a place, thank God, is probably very familiar with the term 1BR. 1BR, 1BA. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, it's a movie about a woman by the name of Sarah who tries to start anew in L.A., where it's probably very hard to find an apartment, but her neighbors are not what they seem. This sounds a lot like the plot to Rosemary's Baby, but it doesn't look like Sarah is married, so, and she's not pregnant, I don't think, so I think that's where the similarities to Rosemary's Baby end. But it is written by and directed by David Marmer and stars Nicole Bryden Bloom as Sarah. And the other actors in the film include Giles Mathey, Taylor Nichols, and Alan Blumenfeld, none of whom I am familiar, but I'm going to give one BR, which is a drama horror thriller, a chance, and I will let you know what I think on next week's show. But if you want to check it out, it is debuting on August 23rd on Netflix, but it is not a Netflix original. There's another film that's debuting on Netflix, or debuting as far as I know. This one's a little older. It's old to me, that is. It's a movie that's called Septembers of Shiraz, and it has a couple of familiar faces in it. It was made in 2015 and was released to select theaters on June 24th, 2016. It stars Salma Hayek and Adrian Brody. And it's about the Iranian Revolution, where prior to it, Iran was a place where people of all religions were allowed to flourish. And this is the story of a prosperous Jewish family who abandoned everything before they are consumed by the passions of revolutionaries. Why I haven't heard of this movie? I have no idea. The plot sounds fantastic. It's based on a novel written by Dahlia Sofer, and it has, of course, Adrian Brody and Salma Hayek in it, who are fantastic actors. It's going to be very interesting to see Salma Hayek presumably play someone who's Jewish, which I think she does, and Iranian for that matter, because she usually doesn't play anybody who's not Mexican or Latina in some way. So, Septembers of Shiraz is a movie that is not brand new, but it is debuting on Netflix on Sunday, August 23rd. That is a movie I will work very hard to see, and I will let you know what I think on next week's show. On Wednesday, August 26th, there's a movie that's called Rising Phoenix, which is a documentary that is premiering on Netflix. And a lot of times when I look up documentaries, I'm not sure if they're documentaries or documentary series. I'm going to look this one up right now. Rising Phoenix is a brand new documentary that I believe is a Netflix original. It is. It's debuting on Netflix on August 26, 2020. It is a sports documentary about the history and current standing of the Paralympic Games, which has grown to become the world's third largest sporting event. Now, I don't know too much about the Paralympic Games. All I know about Paralympic Games is what's been covered in the Academy Award-winning 2005 documentary Murderball, which is about Paralympic athletes who are quadriplegics who play Murderball, which is rugby with wheelchairs. And it looks like a very fun game to watch. And that documentary, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary, was really made me have an appreciation for not only the game itself, but also Paralympic athletes, because that movie told a wealth of stories about the people who played Murderball and also how they got to be in wheelchairs the way they were, how they became quadriplegics, and also had some very staggering misconceptions, or addressed some staggering misconceptions about quadriplegics. But that's about one game in the Paralympics. This movie is about, Rising Phoenix is about the Paralympic Games in general. And the Paralympics is not the same as the Winter Olympics, the Special Olympics. The Special Olympics is separate from the Olympics. The Olympics, winter and summer, are held every 4 years. The exception is the 2020 Summer Games. Those aren't going to be held until next year, but if it hadn't been for COVID-19, they would be. And rest assured, I think the Paralympic Games were supposed to happen this year as well. The Paralympic Games, like the Olympics, happen every 4 years. I don't know if there is a winter Paralympic Games as well as a summer Paralympic Games. I do know there's summer. I don't know if there's winter, but this documentary, at least the subject of it, is fascinating. I hope that this documentary does its subject justice. And this is a movie I will definitely reach out to see or go out of my way to see when it debuts on Netflix on Wednesday, August 26th. And I will let you know what I think on next week's show. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And I'm getting back to the movies that are debuting on streaming the week of August 23rd through August 28th, 2020. And I left off on Wednesday, August 26th, where I told you about the documentary Rising Phoenix, which is about the Paralympics, a documentary I'm very excited to see. On Thursday, August 27th, there are a couple of series that are premiering, but one of the movies that's premiering is one called The Bridge Curse. And this is a brand new film, which is a Netflix original, that is actually not an American film. And the reason I bring that up is you might be disappointed if you realize that the movie is one where you have to read subtitles. But it's directed by Lester Shee, and I believe he is Chinese. I'm going to look that up because I'm not entirely sure. It's not telling me, but based on the names of the actors and the writers of this film, my presumption is that The Bridge Curse is a Chinese film. It's actually Taiwanese. And my correction on that. The Bridge Curse is a Taiwanese film. And it's about a group of undergraduate students who dare to test the urban legend that anyone who crosses a ghostly bridge where a woman once took her own life at midnight will find evil awaiting them. I got to admit, it doesn't sound like a particularly gripping horror film. It sounds like one I've certainly seen before. You know these kids are going to cross over. You know there's going to be a ghost. But then again, I do think that Asian horror films don't pull as many punches as American horror films. So this may be one of those films that get a cult following in the United States, both among Asian American people and non-Asian American people. And eventually the hype builds up and they remake it in the United States. And some of the remakes, like The Ring, the American remakes, have been legitimately scary, but their Asian original counterparts have usually been scarier. So I'm going to see The Bridge Curse. I'm probably going to see it with the lights on because that's how I view horror movies at home. And I will let you know what I think if I do in fact see the movie on next week's show. There is another film that's debuting on Netflix on Thursday, August 27th. And the movie is called The Frozen Ground. And I'm going to look this one up. I actually have seen this movie. This is one that stars Nicolas Cage and John Cusack. I saw this movie on streaming around the time it came out in 2013. And I was actually very impressed by the film. The movie is about an Alaska state trooper who partners with a young woman who escaped the clutches of serial killer Robert Hansen to bring this murderer to justice. This is based on a true story. It's directed by and written by Scott Walker. And Nicolas Cage's repertoire over the last 20 years or so has been hit or miss. In the 90s, he had a really good streak going of excellent films. It began with his movie Leaving Las Vegas and continued into less art house fare like The Rock and The Family Man and other films like that. But I really did think Nicolas Cage was excellent in The Frozen Ground, which takes place in Alaska and actually makes Alaska seem quite frightening, not just the serial killer itself. But Scott Walker is a New Zealand-born writer and director. He made his feature-length debut with The Frozen Ground, and he also, and that's also the last screenplay he wrote to date, which is really too bad. I do hope that The Frozen Ground gives Scott Walker the attention that he deserves, because I think that somebody like him directing a movie as genuinely scary and as thrilling as this one really deserves to at least make a follow-up, which I hope he does sooner or later. And I also have to note John Cusack in this movie is actually scary, and John Cusack is not one of those people who I consider to be scary. So kudos to John Cusack for going out of his usual element of either playing a nice guy or playing somebody in a romantic comedy and playing someone as sinister. Also, Vanessa Hudgens of High School Musical co-stars in this film as well. And I was really rooting for Vanessa Hudgens to have an A-list career because I think she certainly has the acting chops as well as the looks for it. But unfortunately, she released a video on Instagram that she did delete, but unfortunately, because she is such a high-profile name, because so many people follow her, that video lives forever, where she basically downplayed the effects of COVID-19, and in a really, really stupid kind of way. Arguably stupider than Donald Trump. So I really was rooting for her to have an A-list career. It looks like that's not going to happen for quite a while. But taking aside that really dubious, ill-thought Instagram video that she posted, and I don't have an Instagram account. I just know about this from watching videos on YouTube, you know, alerts from news organizations like Now This and Watch Mojo, that she posted it. And my respect for her has dwindled. A little bit, but you know, everybody makes mistakes. The difference between normal people like you and me making a mistake and famous people, of which I'm not yet, is that when a famous person makes a faux pas or says something stupid, it basically lives forever. It's a little bit of a sad fact, but anyway, the movie is The Frozen Ground. It premieres on Netflix on Thursday, August 27th, and this is a movie I do recommend. I certainly have seen this film, and don't be scared away by Nicolas Cage being in it. It is an excellent, thrilling film, and I recommend it. There are two movies that are actually premiering on Friday, August 28th. The first one is called All Together Now, and when I hear that name, All Together Now, or that title, I immediately think of the Beatles song from Yellow Submarine, which is actually one of my favorite Beatles songs. I mean, you can't be in a bad mood when you hear that song, but the movie is about an optimistic high schooler with musical aspirations who must learn to accept help from her friends to overcome her personal hardships and fulfill her dreams. The movie stars, and I really hope I'm pronouncing this name right, Alil Carvalho, and this is Alil Carvalho's first live-action film. She's best known for playing, or for doing the voice of Moana in the titular movie of the same name, which was an excellent Disney animated film, and certainly revamped the idea of what a Disney princess could be. She also, paradoxically, played Ariel, the Little Mermaid, in the 2019 ABC live event, The Little Mermaid Live, with Queen Latifah as Ursula the Sea Witch, and John Stamos as the French chef who tries to cook Sebastian. I haven't seen that movie, but I do think that Alil Carvalho, if I can pronounce her name right, certainly has a dynamic presence even when she's not on the movie screen, like she wasn't in Moana, but she was perfect for the titular character in that movie, and I loved Moana for several reasons, definitely the performance that she did, and All Together Now is a movie I will be seeing. It may not exactly be the film for me. It's definitely a movie about teenagers, and it seems very much like the movie Fame, but at least it looks like a fun film, and certainly one that might be good for a late summer film. And I will see it, and I'll let you know what I think on next week's show. And as I said, there are various films that are available for streaming on Netflix that are not my ideal films that I would see on my own volition without reviewing them on this show. Freak Show, about a gay student who likes to dress in women's clothing, rest assured, is not one of those films that's my preferred films. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm just saying it's not a film I intentionally seek out. But it's a film from which I learn a lot from seeing it, so I think it's well worth it in that regard. The other film I'll briefly mention before I move on is Unknown Originals. Unknown Originals is a Netflix original, which is ironic given the title of the film. It's a movie that will debut on Friday, August 28th, and it actually takes place in Madrid in 2019, and of course this is a Spanish film, although I say of course, but you didn't know that. But it's about a serial killer spreading chaos. This must be a true story. Actually, I stand corrected. There are anonymous people with no apparent connection who are being murdered while imitating the first appearances of the most famous superheroes. Okay, I can't say for sure whether or not this is a true story. It sounds fascinating, though. It's directed by David Galán Galindo, who is a Spanish director, and by Spanish I mean he's from the Republic of Spain. He also co-wrote the screenplay, and this is a film where you have to read, or maybe you don't have to read it, but I prefer to read the subtitles on the bottom of the screen to get the true sense of authenticity of this movie. But I am very eager to see this film. It sounds like a film that would be probably rated PG-13 at least. But I will see it, and I will let you know what I think on next week's show.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.